Hello, and welcome to The World View. The debates around innovation policy take up a lot of oxygen in DC, but the world is big. Join me, Katie Mitchell, a DC insider on the outside, as I shine a light on the bright spots of innovation policy and offer some takeaways for the debate back home. Last week, the plenary of the European Parliament voted to pass the Markets in Crypto Asset, or MiCA, regulation. I don't know about you, but MiCA was everywhere I looked, from explanations about the regulation to celebrations around the milestone that is MiCA. Now, I've been working in innovation policy at the intersection of tech, crypto, and global regulation for some time, so I'm pretty familiar with MiCA, but I always find myself with so much to learn whenever I talk to folks based in Europe and particularly based in Brussels. So I thought, I'm probably not alone here, and if MiCA is as significant as we all seem to agree it is, then we should probably get to understand it a bit better. There are some really great compendiums of analysis out there, and I've linked those in the show notes so you can be sure to check them out. But having a discussion is also really helpful, and we are treated with a fabulous expert on today's podcast. Tommaso Astasi is the head of regulatory affairs at Blockchain for Europe, a Brussels-based trade association representing the blockchain and crypto sectors at the EU level. Tommaso breaks down everything we need to know about MiCA, makes some predictions, fields some of my spicy questions, and does it with a lot of energy and charisma. You might be able to detect this in the podcast itself, but I was fighting a pretty gnarly cold here in the changing seasons of Europe, and yes, I've definitely softened after my years in the tropics, but Tommaso handled my lack of vocal power with a lot of grace, and I'm really grateful to him for carrying the show. Interestingly, I dialed in from Berlin, and Tommaso, who's typically based in Europe, beamed in from Washington, D.C., so it allowed us to share a lot of natural comparisons between the state of crypto regulation in the US and Europe. And wow, last week, the contrast between those jurisdictions could not have been more stark. This is a really great episode. And of course, we encourage you to listen to it in whatever way fits your lifestyle. But you might just be compelled to bust out your notes app or notebook, as I guarantee you, you will learn a lot from the amazing Tommaso. So without further ado, here's everything you need to know about MiCA and then some right here at The World View. All right. Thank you so much, Tommaso, for joining me today. Tommaso's in my native DC, and I'm here in Europe, and I'm really excited to talk about the topic of the hour, day, and week here on the continent, and that's MiCA. MiCA, yesterday, at the time of this recording, officially passed the plenary of the EU Parliament. That might sound like a lot of jargon to some, but don't worry, we'll be unpacking it today. Tommaso, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I think it's indeed it's great timing to have this conversation, considering everything that is happened this week. And yeah, as you said, happy to try and unpack a few of those things, especially for our non-European listeners that might be already wondering what is the European Parliament or what is the MiCA regulation. So yeah, happy to be here. Happy to try a bit of that.
Awesome. So I mentioned that Tommaso is currently in Washington, D.C. And if I think about, I'm a D.C. denizen and native, and I'm going to totally brand my particular type of nerdy millennial here. But when I think about civics and political process, I go back to my childhood and I think about the cartoon Schoolhouse Rock, that for those unacquainted is a really great series. You should check it out on YouTube. And there's a video called I'm Just a Bill. And there's a cartoon bill sitting on Capitol Hill. I will stop singing. And it talks about the whole process of ideation to becoming a law.
I don't know if we have a European version of that. And Tommaso, I'm not going to ask you to sing unless you want to.
I can try and make up a quick song, but no, I think it's, I've seen the cartoon and it's something that we should probably do as well, because I haven't seen a European version of it indeed.
Yeah. So if we were to create our own version on this episode, and talk about the European process from ideation to regulation and eventually implementation, because we have listeners from all over the world for this podcast, I wondered if you could level the playing field and start us off on the right page and just walk us through the typical process in Europe.
Sure. Happy to try. I say try because I have to say the European legislative process is probably definitely one of the most complicated that there is out there. And I'm saying that after having studied all of that back in university and now having worked in this field for a few years, I still struggle sometimes to actually keep track of everything that happens from the origin of a bill to its conclusion. Maybe let's start actually from the easy part. We don't call them bills. That's a very, I think we see that as a very American way to call them. In Europe, we actually have two different types of bills, or in our case, legislative acts. And these are, it's actually interesting to start from that, because we have directives and regulations. And in this case, we're going to be talking about a regulation. So a legislative proposal that once it's finalized, like the MiCA regulation now basically is, becomes directly applicable in all the 27 EU member states. So it becomes directly EU law, right? So once the MiCA regulation will be officially published in the official journal of the European Union, we're going to get to that in a moment, but that's law in the whole continent and directly applicable in all courts. Directives instead are different instruments, also very important and quite common, which actually leaves a bit more of a freedom for interpretation to the different member states. So the 27 member states that compose the European Union then would have to implement a directive that is finalized at EU level, would have to implement it into national legislation, which means that that could actually create differences in how the different member states interpret that law and implement those rules. Anyway, so after this very quick disclaimer on directives and regulations, thinking about how these actually all come to be, we have three institutions in the European Union, three main institutions: the European Commission, the European Parliament, and the Council of the EU. The European Commission is basically, let's say, the group of experts and officials, government officials and civil servants that basically have an expertise in certain topics. And they are the ones, the European Commission is the institution actually bring forward a new proposal. So a new legislative proposal comes out of the European Commission. And the other two institutions are called the co-legislators, exactly because they will then look at this proposal, form their own opinion on it, and then once they have done so, they will basically get together in what we call the trilogue negotiations, where the European Commission, the Council of the EU, and the European Parliament will sit down with the three versions at that point of a certain legislative text and try to find a compromise of that. Maybe just a very quick disclaimer again, when I talk about the Council of the EU and the European Parliament, it's interesting also to try and make a comparison a bit with the you know, United States, for example. The Council of the EU is more or less the Senate, right? Because they have it's the representatives in Brussels of the interests of the 27 member states. So it's more or less an extension of the national governments. And you can see there why it somehow resembles the structure of the Senate with the different states represented. The European Parliament instead is very much the directly elected body, right? So EU citizens vote through European elections. They vote their representatives in different constituencies and parties and form the European Parliament with 750 and more members. So again, these are the three institutions. A bill, basically, as I said, a legislative proposal in the European Union is proposed by the European Commission. And then the other two institutions do their own, let's say, work analysis to define their own positions on this file, And then again, they come together to try and find a compromise at the end.
Yeah, and I think that makes the US process almost look pedestrian in terms of the complexity in the EU. And it makes a comprehensive framework like what we have in MiCA even more impressive, honestly, if you think about the amount of coordination and alignment that you need to achieve within the European system in order to get to where we are as of today. What is the typical timeline if you were to estimate it? And I know it has to vary between issues and types of regulation, but what would you say is the typical timeline from the consensus that we need to move towards regulation to actually getting to the phase where we are today?
Yeah, well, if we look at the MiCA timeline for it, to take it as an example, it's more or less a pretty good example, because in the end, the original proposal by the European Commission was published on the 20th of September 2020. The final vote, as we discussed, as we just said, in the European Parliament happened yesterday, so on 20th of April 2023, and then there is still one final vote happening in the Council, very much a formality at this stage, and finally the text will be published in the official journal of the European Union in June. That basically means that from the original proposal of the Commission to the actual publication of the text in the official journal of the European Union, we had more or less 2 years and 9 months. That's a pretty fair timeline for a legislative proposal to go through this whole complicated process, as we're saying. Obviously, there is some issues and some files that have taken much longer than that. Just to make an example, like the discussions on the e-privacy directives, probably started in 2014, 2015, are still basically being finalized because of the complexity of the file. So overall, let's say that from the actual proposal to the end of the process is 2 to 3 years. But then at the same time, the publication of the original proposal is not really the start of the process. There is actually things that happen before then. There is public consultations, which can be more informal or informal, done by the European Commission with different stakeholders to really try and understand what to include in a legislative proposal. So overall, I would actually say that the whole process to get from zero, where no one really was talking about crypto regulation yet in Europe, to where we are today, is actually something more like 4 to 5 years. Because the very first discussions on the future crypto regulatory framework in Europe started actually in 2018, which is, by the way, also when our association Blockchain for Europe was founded, exactly because we wanted to call for this future regulatory framework for crypto assets.
Yeah, and that's a great plug for Blockchain for Europe. We'll include in the show notes a link to your organization if folks aren't already members or want to see the work that you're doing. They can check that out. It's interesting because I often make the joke, I've been in crypto for about a year and fintech policy for much longer than that. But I always say that we're kind of operating in dog years, and that a week feels like a decade sometimes, oh, yes. Especially in the last year. So, well, on one hand, obviously, it's impressive to pull this together, but you also have to remark and kind of reflect on how much has changed in our industry and be a little bit sympathetic to the role of regulators in trying to create the right guardrails with such a kind of complex and fast-moving space like crypto. So I just have to reflect on that a little bit personally. Yeah. So if we go back to the origins, now that we have the kind of baseline and the time frame, and in your view, Tommaso, if you were to kind of create the origin story for MiCA, or at least share some of where you think MiCA came from, what was the main impetus by European lawmakers in terms of coming up with this framework?
Yeah, well, there is a few very clear moments which really define then the future developments for this crypto regulatory framework. So first of all, as we say, back in 2017, 2018, you know, the time of the ICO eras and where the crypto asset market was finally becoming something that everybody was talking about, obviously policymakers and regulators started realizing that maybe our current regulatory frameworks are not really ready for what is happening on these crypto asset markets. And so I think the very first discussion was actually in 2018 when the Commission actually called on the financial supervisory authorities in Europe to start assessing whether the current existing EU financial law would actually apply to crypto assets like Bitcoin. And so that was the first moment where they realized, well, you know, maybe we do need to update our rules for what is happening in this sector. Other important considerations back then was the fact that the anti-money laundering regulation, or sorry, anti-money laundering framework in the EU was, as I mentioned at the beginning, was regulated through a directive, which means that, you know, there were very fragmented and, you know, different approaches by the different member states to rules on registering crypto asset service providers, for example, or giving out licenses to these companies that were experimenting with this new sector. So that was also an important reason why the European Union realized that, well, we may have to do something to harmonize these rules and make sure that everybody's somehow complying with them, of course, but also that we're giving this industry an actual opportunity to comply with these rules, right? And, you know, we're going to get to that point, but obviously I'm sure our listeners start to realize the difference with the approach taken by the European Union and by our friends on the other side of the Atlantic, or here in Washington, actually, where I'm speaking from. But then I would say the actual story there that everybody who's involved in this sector and these discussions know about by now, but maybe it's interesting for those that haven't heard about it yet. But the real moment where things got serious, let's put it like that, is when Facebook, or now called Meta, in June 2019 announced that wanted to launch its Libra and then renamed Diem project. And this Libra project was meant to be this digital asset that Facebook users could have used to basically pay for services and goods on their platform and exchange value, exchange things on the Facebook platform, for example, basically just using this digital asset without at that point having to go through the fiat system anymore, right? So because if you can buy and sell something on Facebook directly using the Zuckbuck or whatever it was supposed to be called, then you don't really need to go through the banking system anymore. So that was really the moment where policymakers realized, okay, we need to do something. We have to prevent a situation where a big tech, especially American company, can produce a digital asset that can be used by European citizens and basically reduce our monetary sovereignty in Europe. Yeah. So this story is really interesting because then it actually shows also why MiCA is what it is, and certain parts of the MiCA regulation that were clearly written in with Libra in mind, now they don't even make much sense anymore. But we're going to get to that in a moment, I think. But that's, I think, a good way to place the origin story of the MiCA regulation.
Yeah, and I guess like one question is, it kind of, I think MiCA, as I look at it, it's almost like it's comprehensive. An alternative word for that would be like Frankensteinian. Like you add a lot of different parts to it that create this comprehensive piece, but you also can see that there's a bit of a patchwork approach because of these different concerns that that Europe was seeking to address. And you know, in DC where you are today, this past week we had hearings that are very kind of like narrowly focused, right? There's a stablecoin focused hearing, or there might be one more specifically on another set of the crypto ecosystem. And I've seen in other jurisdictions like Singapore, where I live, that there are parallel track efforts to look at stablecoin regulation and more comprehensive protections around crypto, but they're not packaged necessarily together, though they're running in concert with one another. And they definitely refer to each other, but the EU is unique in the sense that it's all kind of in this omnibus package, right? So I think that's a really helpful way of framing where we landed in terms of where we began. So now to the meat of it, we've talked about MiCA, and I think it would be helpful. It's a really long piece of regulation, right? And I'm sure you've done the good work of reading through it more times.
I unfortunately had to, several times.
And there are some really great summaries. And again, I love to shout out great thinkers in this space. So I'll link some of those too, but we'll try our best so that you can multitask, get your coffee, go for your run, drive, bike, whatever you're doing, and also get a download on what is Mika. I've seen it all over my Twitter feed. I've seen it on my LinkedIn. It may have been referenced elsewhere, but what does it actually entail? And then we might start to kind of grade it and evaluate things that we think are really awesome for industry, other things that will be a little bit challenging to implement or to adopt in future.
Yeah, well, very happy to give it a try. As you said, it's a massive piece of legislation, and so obviously just trying to discern every single provision of this over 500 pages text will probably be a bit too long and boring for your listeners, but let's give it a try. Especially, I would like to start from the main objectives, right? What is actually the objective of the MiCA regulation? What did the European Union try to achieve with it? I would say the first, obviously, and especially when we talk about European Union policy, the first objective is always protecting consumers, right? So, and this is also something that can be perceived a bit of a concern in terms of the overall approach of European Union policymaking, because sometimes then innovation kind of loses out from that. But obviously, so first objective was to protect consumers from risks existing, of course, in the crypto asset market. As we mentioned, when it was published was exactly during the ICO craze. And so obviously there were risk perceived with this crypto asset market. But then the other main objective of the regulation, as we mentioned, the European Union is this complicated set of 27 different member states with 27 different legislative legislations, right? So the main objective was actually to introduce regulatory harmonization, right? To create one single rule book for the whole European Union, which would have provided the so much needed legal certainty for these companies that wanted to come to Europe, provide their services, and exactly know what they could do, what they could not do, what requirements apply to their services, and so on, and also be able to achieve full harmonization and access to the full market, right? Because the beauty of MiCA, probably the most important one aspect of MiCA, is the fact that once you get a license in a European member state, then you will be able to passport that license throughout the whole European Union and be able to provide your services to the wider, you know, over 500 million people single market. So that's probably the most important objectives. And of course, you know, the European Union really tried to do something that is now been applauded as a great effort, a great initiative to basically trying and taking the lead in this Web3 race, right? So trying to be the first major jurisdictions in the world to really introduce, as you say, this comprehensive regulatory framework for crypto asset service providers and for issuers of tokens and all of that. So after having described these major objectives, let's try and actually break down what does actually MiCA entail, what does it regulate, and so on. First aspect that I would like to flag is basically that MiCA focuses on centralized actors and intermediaries, right? So that is the very first important thing to mention. So MiCA focuses on all those centralized actors that are providing services to the crypto asset markets, or those intermediaries that provide services, which means that basically decentralized entities are actually excluded from the scope of the regulatory framework, as long as these entities are providing crypto asset services in a fully decentralized manner with no intermediary. Now, this obviously raises already some questions. We're going to get to that in a moment, but this is important to clarify that, at least from reading the provisions, DeFi entities, decentralized protocols are excluded from the scope of the regulatory framework. But then again, there is some nuances, and those need to be answered later on, and we're going to get to that. other important distinction, MiCA does not cover financial instruments, right? So all those assets that somehow resemble existing financial instruments, those will remain covered by the MiFID, which is another directive, the Marketing Financial Instruments Directive, which covers financial instruments, the offering of financial instruments, and all those rules related to that. So any crypto asset, and you know, this obviously is, resembles obviously the debate in the US with the security versus commodities, but every crypto asset that will be classified as a security will remain captured by the existing security laws in the European Union, and especially regulated by the ESMA, the European Security and Market Authority. What actually MiCA does, and it's probably the most interesting thing of the whole regulation, is that it creates a taxonomy of different assets. So it really tries to define all the different assets that we're talking about in this sector, and it creates four major categories. First one being utility tokens, and utility tokens are quite a particular one because they remain more or less outside of the scope, in the sense that as long as a token is only meant to be used within a closed private ecosystem for accessing services, or you know, a token that gives you certain rights within that ecosystem, that remains a token just that provides utility in that ecosystem, and so remains outside of most of the other requirements and rules applicable to the other crypto assets, right? So this is also quite interesting, of course.
So sorry to interject, maybe to bring it to Earth for some folks, like what's a good example of a utility token? And I know we're in early stages, so it might be hard to define, and totally fine if you don't feel comfortable doing so. But can we throw out a useful kind of example for folks to tether to?
So utility tokens are really tokens that are issued and accepted only by the same issuer, right? So that is really the distinction classification of it. So whenever there is an issuer that creates, for example, let's take the CryptoKitties example, right? So a platform, an ecosystem where you can have your own digital kitty and so on, and basically the tokens used in that ecosystem that remain only accepted and issued and accepted only within that platform remain utility tokens. And also those tokens will not be then traded on other trading platforms, right? So that's really probably the easiest way now to think about utility tokens.
Okay.
But then there is not really many examples out there. So that is also another example of how the European Union work actually went, right? So there were some categories of things that were defined back then, but then now probably wouldn't make much sense anymore considering the latest developments in the market. And that's probably a good segue, if you allow me, to actually go to the next category, because that's the next category in this taxonomy that we're talking about, is the asset reference tokens. And asset reference tokens are stable coins, but those stable coins that are really aiming at stabilizing their value by referencing or slash pegging to a basket of currencies, different commodities or other crypto assets or other non-fiat currency assets. So basically, when there is a basket of commodities, of assets, and there is a token that is pegged to that basket of assets. Now, probably, you know, your listener and yourself are probably wondering once again, well, what is a good example of an asset reference token? Well, Libra was the perfect example of an asset reference token. Libra was exactly the reason why the European Union introduced this category of asset reference tokens in the taxonomy of the MiCA regulation. Well, but then now we're not exactly sure if there would be any other project that will fall under this category. So again, it shows how, you know, the external developments and events in the market has always influenced the work of the European Union in this sense. So then after the asset reference tokens, we actually have the other category of stable coins that most of us are more familiar with. Those are called e-money tokens. And e-money tokens are stable coins that aim at stabilizing their value by referencing a fiat currency, right? So all the, obviously, the most common examples being USDC, USDT, Binance USD, or the ones that are finally being launched now by Circle and other companies that are referencing the euro. so the Eurosea. So that's more or less an existing concept already in European legislation with the e-money legislation. And so it's more or less a similar requirement that were already introduced for e-money in Europe. But then again, of course, now with a blockchain perspective within those categories. And finally, the other category, the final category, is basically all other crypto assets, right? So it's more of an exercise of eliminating going by exclusion, right? So if your asset is not a financial instrument, if your asset is not a utility token, if your asset is not an asset reference token or an e-money token, because it doesn't respect those criteria, well, then it will fall probably under the category of other crypto assets. And so all other crypto assets are then put in this major bucket. And of course, then there are the point of these taxonomies that the MiCA regulation defines different requirements for the issuers of different tokens, right? So there is a general requirement for all issuers of all tokens that we mentioned so far to publish a white paper, beside for utility tokens. Again, utility tokens don't even need a white paper. All other tokens need a white paper. And this is actually a very interesting aspect, because the European Union basically relied on white papers as being this source of information, of disclosure, that projects need to somehow take some responsibility with, right? So if you're asking projects to issuers of different tokens to somehow clarify their project, what is it about, their roadmap, who's behind it, but also, for example, how the tokenomics work, all those aspects that are generally included in white papers so far, but now will be mandatory for projects to disclose those information about their asset, as well as the environmental impact of the technology used to issue their tokens. This is really interesting again. This came to be this environmental impact requirement was introduced as a compromise between the different institutions, as we were discussing before in the trilogue negotiations, because then there was a push in the European Parliament to actually ban proof of work tokens, right?
Yeah, so, I remember that.
Exactly. So the whole crypto Twitter remembers that, because for a couple of days, everybody was like, oh my God, they're banning Bitcoin in the European Union. Well, even though that's, you know, obviously wouldn't have been possible probably in practice, but we were really close to having at least the European Parliament text really calling for a ban of all proof of work based tokens as of 2025 because of the energy consumption of proof of work consensus mechanism. Well, the final outcome of this, the final compromise, which is much more acceptable, of course, is that token issuers, as we were saying, at least need to inform their users, inform investors of the environmental impact of the technology used to issue their token. And so then that would at least help potentially investors to choose a green token over a less green token.
We'll talk about that, I think, in detail in terms of like feasibility of implementation, but that particularly strikes me as difficult for some smaller projects. Obviously, some of the larger tokens have a little bit more of a community and a more resource rather to be able to ascertain that. But even as the ways by which we validate tokens continues to change and evolve, and the way by which energy consumption hopefully innovates to become more sustainable in parallel, that seems to be a really tricky thing to nail down. So I think the devil will be in the implementation and how we can actually come into compliance as industry with that.
Indeed, I think you're very much pointing to the most important aspect, I think, of this whole discussion, is that the implementation is what matters, right? So it's great to have a great, law that is written well. Obviously, there's still some questions to that, but we're going to get to it. But then again, you know, if it's not implemented right, if it's not enforced right, then it doesn't really achieve the objectives that we were talking before.
Yeah. So we have the taxonomy, and it's interesting because in Australia, like, they actually took a very sequenced approach, or are taking, I should say, a sequenced approach, in which they issued this token mapping exercise, and then they're going to layer on recommendations for regulation forthcoming kind of, or post rather, some feedback from industry on their taxonomy proposal. And Mika, it's all kind of bound together. So we're getting it all at the same time. Yep. What are some of the market standards that we have in Mika as well?
Yeah, exactly. As you say, like the European Union tried to do a bit of everything together, which probably will be useful because at least we will have this legal clarity for almost everything that is relevant for this sector once MiCA comes into force. Beside the asset taxonomy, which of course is the foundation of everything else in the MiCA text, what MiCA does is that it defines crypto asset services, right? And once you have defined, you know, exchange activities, custody, operating a trading platform, the placement of assets, or even providing advice and portfolio management as crypto asset services, it means that if you want to provide those services in Europe, you will need to get a crypto asset service provider license. So we will talk about CASPs in Europe, which is more or less the translation of the FATF virtual asset service provider definition. We call them crypto asset service providers. And so CASP will then have different requirements depending on their activity, but you know, more or less there is some minimum capital on funds requirements. There is obviously all the rules for operating a trading platform, how to notify competent authorities about it, and similar rules like that. What is interesting, for example, is that crypto asset service providers that are already somehow licensed in one European member state, right? Because as we said, some European member states already have somehow a licensing procedure, a registration procedure in their own legislation. Those companies that are already providing services in Europe through those licenses will also have, for example, an accelerated license procedure to basically update their national license to become a CASP European license, and will also have like this transitional period of 18 months to actually receive the final license under MiCA, meaning that they can actually continue to operate in that time frame. The other rules, of course, are on market abuse rules. There is some rules on manipulation, of course, and insider trading. So those, I would say, are the overall most interesting aspects and rules introduced by MiCA. As we said, of course, then each different category has a different set of rules, a different set of requirements that get a bit more detailed, of course.
All of this is really good marketing for blockchain for Europe, just to have, especially for, I think, smaller entities, right? If you don't have an army of compliance colleagues or legal colleagues, or are not sure how to navigate the process and just the network that I think associations can provide and guidance preliminarily for companies, is really important, because MiCA is comprehensive, but the other side of comprehensive is complex, right? And so I think it's going to be a big task for a lot of folks who aren't used to this to come into compliance. But still, we have the regulatory path ahead of us, which is great. And that's, you know, a win in and of itself. We talked a little bit about what isn't in MiCA, but I wanted to spend a little bit of time on that. And you mentioned the ban Bitcoin fear that was all across Twitter. It wasn't the only time my algorithms conspired to show me a lot of MiCA fear. And I was working on kind of global crypto policy at the time, so worked on some of these issues as well. But you're the expert here, so I would love to talk about some of the notable exclusions. You mentioned DeFi. Yeah. There was also just within that some fear around how self-hosted wallets would come into the picture as well, NFTs. And we'll talk a little bit about the broader constellation of regulations in Europe, because while MiCA is the omnibus in a lot of ways, it's also not the only game in town. So there's even more complexity to consider. But I thought I would love for you to kind of take us through some of the notable exclusions so that we can talk about that process and why perhaps they weren't included in this iteration of MiCA.
Yeah, and that's I think that's also a very good way to put it, right? So this these basically categories that we're going to mention now were not included in this iteration of MiCA, especially because the European Commission, which more or less we like to think as the adult in the room sometimes, really the one body that tries to have the least biased position, the most, also open position and also acknowledging their own shortcomings, right? And this was really, I would say, applaudable from them to basically acknowledge the fact that they didn't yet fully understand DeFi or, yeah, for example, NFTs, right? These two, especially these two categories, these two aspects of the Web3 ecosystem were so new or so also rapidly changing and developing that the European Commission really thought, okay, well, it's probably not the best thing to try and regulate everything now without really having understood what it's in front of us. Right. So, and this was the case both for DeFi and for NFTs. There were pushes from the European Parliament, for example, to introduce both to really make sure that MiCA, one, this first MiCA iteration, as you said, really already covered all of this, already covered DeFi, already covered NFTs. But the Commission said, you know what, we probably need to understand it better. And so MiCA actually mandates the Commission to produce reports within 18 months from the entry into force of MiCA. So we're talking about, and we're going to, have a better overview of the whole timeline, but let's say end of 2024, that's when the European Commission will basically have to come out with a couple of reports that are really going to be important and interesting, both for DeFi and NFTs, and potentially accompany these reports with legislative proposals to try and, again, bring into the regulatory scope DeFi and NFTs. Now, we're saying that NFTs and DeFi are outside of scope because that's what the provisions say, right? So the provision of the MiCA tax say, literally, this regulation does not apply to decentralized decentralized entities, to tokens issued by decentralized entities, and it also does not apply to non-fungible tokens. Well, that's great until you actually go and read between the lines the so-called recitals, which is more or less the preambles to the actual provisions of the regulation. And so the recitals are really important. They're not as important as the provisions, but they're really important because they help authorities to interpret the law, right? So the recitals language is, in the end, plays a very important role in that. And in this case, the recital language is really confusing because it talks about, for example, in the case of DeFi, it talks about truly decentralized entities that are providing their services without any intermediary, right? And as soon as, at least in the recital language, it says that as soon as there is somehow some individuals or some legal person that are identifiable and are somehow directly or indirectly controlling a decentralized autonomous organization, for example, including through smart contracts and voting protocols, then that DAO will not be really a DAO, will not be really DeFi, would actually be, as the European Commission likes to call them, a DINO, which is a decentralized in-name only entity, right? So the European Union really tried to make a distinction between those projects that are true DeFi and those projects that like to call themselves DeFi without really being DeFi. Now, I know that all the listeners are probably raising their eyebrows and start to questioning, like, what does this actually mean in practice? Well, again, this is something we need to clarify in the coming months. It's not exactly clear at this stage, but the idea is that the Commission wanted to create this distinction between decentralized entities, truly decentralized entities, and DINOs. Same goes for NFTs. NFTs are excluded from the scope, but then there is a recital that talks about NFTs issued in a large series of or collection, which will basically mean that they become fungible again, because if they're issued in a massive collection, then there is a question like how different they are from one another. So again, NFTs are outside of scope, but do we need to get more clarity on what actually will be classified as NFTs and what could actually be potentially reclassified by company authorities as fungible tokens and then potentially as crypto assets or as financial instruments, depending on their de facto characteristics. So again, those two are probably the most interesting open questions that we have in front of us. The rest, as you mentioned, the issue with self-hosted wallets, that's more or less also part of MiCA, but it actually was addressed in this other piece of legislation, which is called the transfer of funds regulation, which was also adopted yesterday. So the whole process was very much aligned between the TFR and MiCA. And the TFR is more or less, it's actually literally the implementation of the FATF travel rule onto the crypto assets market. And so the European Union very much applied the travel rule by the FATF as recommended by the FATF, and so requested that certain information on the originator and beneficiary of every crypto asset transfer where there is a regulated entity involved would then be, need to be accompanied by certain personal information, again, on the beneficiary and originator of the transfer. Now, these obviously became quite, important when talking about self-hosted wallets, because, of course, it was acceptable and understood why this rule could make sense between, let's say, I'm transferring my crypto asset to you from my Binance account to your Coinbase account. Well, Binance and Coinbase then have to exchange some information about me and you, and that is, about it. But then what happens when I want to transfer some assets to your self-hosted wallet, your MetaMask account, right? Yeah. Well, then that obviously becomes a bit of a problem because my Binance account cannot really verify whether your information, your self-provided information, where you signed up to MetaMask is accurate, or that you are really the person behind that specific self-hosted wallet address. That became a very actually toxic debate in the European Parliament, where some members of the European Parliament, some groups especially, were really pushing strong for requesting a verification of the identity of the users of self-hosted wallets, which obviously wouldn't have worked and would have probably just created the opposite of what they wanted to achieve, right? Because if I have to verify the information or of a self-hosted wallet from someone else, of which obviously is not possible in that at that stage, then I would rather just move my asset to my own self-hosted wallet and then transfer from my own self-hosted wallet to your own self-hosted wallet. And that obviously goes outside of the oversight of regulated entities that actually have, KYC requirements and things like that, right? So we actually managed to show the policymakers at that point that what they were suggesting was going to go completely against the objective of the AML framework. And so then we luckily landed in a much better position where basically, when you want to transfer assets from your regulated entity accounts, or from, let's say, from my Binance account, I want to transfer asset to my own self-hosted wallet, then Binance needs to ensure that I'm actually the owner of the old self-hosted wallet. Mm-hmm. Well, and that's it. And if I actually want to transfer asset from my Binance account to your own self-hosted wallet, Binance will ask me to add some information, like, name of the owner, and I can write Katie Mitchell in that case. But then, of course, Binance is not going to ask for a verification of that identity.
Got it.
Just because MetaMask in that case will not be a regulated entity, it's just a software provider. Anyway, so after this long discussion on self-hosted wallets, I think it's interesting just to say that the debate on this aspect is actually not over yet, because now there is the AML regulation debate in the European Parliament, which is more or less going back to the same issue. But we are again pushing back, and I mean we as Blockchain for Europe, but many other stakeholders and associations involved in the policymaking process in Brussels are very much pushing back on this idea that you need to verify identity of everybody to to basically avoid money laundering and terrorist financing.
Yeah, and I think it's actually a nice segue because you addressed a couple of things. A little bit had to do with the timeline, and we'll get into timeline and implementation now. But also, when we're seeking clarity on things like definition of truly decentralized, or even how some of these adjacent regulatory frameworks interact with compliance for MiCA. There are a couple of things that I think it would be helpful to outline. First of all, okay, what's next? We have MiCA, we talked about the contours, what does implementation look like? And then importantly and crucially, what is the role of industry associations, the general public and the crypto community in providing feedback, and how receptive generally do EU members tend to be in terms of listening to that stakeholder group in Europe?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, let's starting from the timeline, from the easy one. We had, as I said, the final vote in the European Parliament yesterday. There is going to be a final vote also in the Council of the EU on the 16th of May, most likely. And that's really the end of the legislative process of MiCA, which then is published in the official journal of the European Union, let's say in June. 20 days later, that moment, the text officially enters into force. But then again, the rules don't really apply for some more time, because MiCA basically has this transitional period, which means that if the entry into force of the regulation is in June 2023, the rules for stablecoin issuers will apply as of June 2024, so 1 year later. And then all the other rules, everything else that we talked about, will actually only apply 18 months later from the entry into force. And that brings us to January 2025, more or less. So that's just to give a quick overview of the timeline. But then again, and this is also part of the other question, MiCA, as we call it, as a level one legislation, meaning that it sets these, you know, major comprehensive rules and definitions and so on. But then there is a lot of questions, a lot of criteria and things that will be defined by the level two legislation. And the level two legislation in Europe is all these guidelines, regulatory technical standards, and other kind of technical standards that will be defined by the European Commission again, but also then by the European supervisory authorities. And these are the European Banking Authority and the European Security and Markets Authority. And so these two other bodies will have a very important role in the next 1.5 years to define a lot of these questions. For example, as we just discussed on the NFT situation, well, ESMA, the European Security Markets Authority, by January 2025 will basically define guidelines to actually assess and classify crypto assets as potentially financial instruments or other type of crypto assets, which will hopefully provide also some more clarity on the situation for NFTs. So this is just an example of everything that is going to happen in the next 12 to 18 months. And to answer your question, well, that's, again, means that, you know, our work is not done, is not over at all, even though yesterday we obviously all celebrated at a very important moment. But actually, whoever is involved in this process from the start knows that this is just a very important milestone, but it's not the end. So the work will continue from all interested stakeholders and associations to make their voice heard, to provide input, to provide feedback to all of these guidelines and regulatory technical standards that will be defined by the supervisory authorities. And so, again, which is, you know, it's probably the least easy part of this process in terms of engaging with the policymakers and the regulators, because the opportunities to engage with the policymakers and provide feedback and provide input to the laws were quite a lot at the beginning, especially before the proposal was out. And then there's always obviously the opportunity to discuss with the European Parliament, with the Council of the EU, what our position was on certain topics, certain issues, that all of those that we discussed. But then now, basically, you know, as we say, the level one text is over. The level two discussion start, and we need to remain very active with our engagement with the regulators, with the supervisory authorities, to provide the industry feedback on their future work as they finalize basically all the small details of the text.
It's just like a video game, Tommaso.
Yes.
As soon as you finish level one, level two, it's going to get a little bit harder.
Oh, it will. Oh, yes, it will.
And, it's fun. It's fun.
I'm a bit afraid about the final boss of level two.
Yeah.
Which, in my mind, I guess, has the face of Gary Gensler, but that's
Yeah, good stuff. I mean, and then we've seen this. It was not necessarily in regulation, but my hit by past is in payments. And so obviously we know that the Payment Services Directive was not just the directive itself, that there were many iterations and even potential future iterations of that. And as the industry evolves, it's hard to imagine MiCA too, because the timelines that you projected, at least in when I think about crypto years and crypto days and decades, that still seems far away, right? And so when we come to kind of January 2025, our industry is going to be in a totally different place. We know that just by looking back to this January. So I'm sure there will be a MiCA too, but what it will seek to entail and cover, I think it might be hard to predict at this juncture. Is that fair?
Yeah, that is a very fair assessment. I mean, there is already, of course, some stakeholders, some policymakers that are already calling for a MiCA too. And obviously, we are all like, please don't. Like, give us some time to actually celebrate this first file, and then we can focus on the second one. But jokes aside, as you said, you know, things will change. Things will develop in the market. There is obviously some areas that are already clearly potential gaps of the MiCA one. For example, MiCA doesn't really cover staking and lending activities.
Yeah.
So that's the very, let's say, the first two suspects that could be potentially addressed by a MiCA 2.0. In terms of a timeline, look, if nothing crazy happens, which obviously we cannot know, we cannot predict, because considering what happened in the
knock
past
on
year,
wood.
Knock
yeah.
on wood. But if nothing like that happens in the next few years, then we have some time, because the European Commission will basically reevaluate the application of the MiCA regulation with an interim report in 2 years. So that's basically June 2025. And then the final review of application of MiCA, that will be in 4 years. So
yeah,
that's
okay.
June 2027. So in theory, if nothing crazy happens, if things don't change considerably, then until July 2027, we wouldn't have a MiCA 2 proposal. But, you know, again, we cannot really predict what happens in the crypto market.
Yeah, just other technologies, like I saw something about kind of an AI-managed DeFi protocol. And what does that mean in terms of decentralized? Man, oh man, like I think there's going to be just so much accelerating and convergence of technology that it's going to make it really interesting and make encyclopedias like Tommaso totally relevant for in perpetuity, which is great. I guess before we move on to kind of final set here and talk about MiCA in the global context, you addressed this slightly, but I am curious, and I can't help because you are in DC and I'm a political animal. What are the politics of of MiCA, and how do European politics and how that might evolve in the next couple of years contribute to how we think about MiCA? Is crypto a politically charged topic, like either in the affirmative, like I'm a pro crypto candidate, or as we see in the US with Senator Warren from Massachusetts, she actually is running kind of an anti-crypto campaign. Is that something that's uniquely American, or do we see strands of that also in Europe?
So I wouldn't say that it's uniquely American, but definitely we don't have the same polarized debate that there is in the US, right? So in the US, if you are a Republican and you're pro-crypto, if you're a Democrat, you're anti-crypto. That's more or less the divide that there is. And we saw that actually playing out when we had the luck of hosting a delegation of staffers from the US Congress that came to Brussels in the end of February, literally to actually learn from the European Union what they have done with MiCA, understand what were the good things about MiCA and the bad things that the US could try and do better. And we, as Blockchain for Europe, had the honor of actually hosting this delegation, organize an industry roundtable about it with them to discuss this topic. And again, we saw literally this internal politics play out in this discussion where even the most, friendly staffers in that sense, or anyway, representatives that somehow had been closer to the industry could not really show back home how close they were right now, or the fact that they were even talking with the crypto industry. And that has a lot to do with FTX, of course, because, you know, obviously Congress and a lot of people in Congress are still burned by what happened and their relationship with Sam Bankman-Fried. So obviously, again, going back to Europe, we don't have the same exact situation, but of course it's not, you know, so unique. And we have more or less also a similar divide across the political spectrum, where the left-wing parties have been a bit more critical about the crypto sector, about the risks connected with crypto assets and so on, while the center right wing, or, you know, the other liberal parties in the European Parliament were a bit more industry friendly in that sense, or at least innovation friendly, I would call them, because they realize the potential of the innovation and they said, okay, well, it's important, of course, to protect consumers, but let's introduce a regulatory framework that does both, right? That protects our consumers while also allowing for this amazing innovation of blockchain technology to really show its full potential. So more or less similar party lines. But then again, this also goes back to the fact that we don't really have a bipartisan system, right? In Europe, many more political groups and parties. And so, of course, there is a wider range of positions and opinions on the topic.
That sounds refreshing. It's interesting because I was always, especially when I entered this space, I was always hoping that crypto wouldn't become kind of, wouldn't fall along partisan fault lines. And I wrote, my latest Substack was about kind of the politicization of crypto. And I think it's interesting because you don't see it as charged. In fact, you actually see in other jurisdictions, presidential candidates or different government entity candidates campaigning on pro-innovation, pro-Web3 platforms. So, that's a trend that I hope persists because, you know, why not embrace innovation pragmatically? We seem to be plagued by that partisanship a little bit more in the US, for sure. Okay. So last bit here, the way that Europe has made a moniker for itself in terms of the Brussels effect. And this was coined by a professor at my alma mater, Columbia University, Anna Bradford. She had a book titled The Brussels Effect, How the EU Rules the World, which is like super pithy and very, very good title. And I think it comes from, as you well know, Tommaso, it comes from the idea that the European Union has had some of these groundbreaking, comprehensive frameworks. The one that harkens to my mind, and I really saw play out when I worked at Visa and a few other companies, was GDPR. And we really saw, especially in the Asia Pacific, a lot of major economies replicate. They would put their own spin on it, but really replicate the principles around GDPR. And there are pluses and minuses to that. If you really like the regulation, that's awesome. If it's really difficult, you might not want that to be a chief export of Europe. But obviously, depending upon what other markets do, there is some incentive just by the size of the single European market to come into compliance with MiCA. And once you come into compliance with MiCA, you want to be able to then scale that to other markets in which you're operating. So I think there is that just natural effect. But we also have concurrent to this vote, recent meetings in DC with the IMF and the World Bank. The G20 is meeting again soon. The finance ministers met on the margins of the spring meetings in DC. Japan, which does itself have its own crypto framework, is the host of the G7, and they have kind of top of mind to cover international coordination of crypto. You have these international bodies like the IMF and the Financial Stability Board. This is their task, more or less, to do that. But now you have MiCA, and there has to be a role for MiCA to play here. So what do you think this means in terms of the Brussels effect, and how do you think Europe is going to, or will it regulate the world when it comes to crypto?
Yeah, that was a very good, initial description of all of this. And as you point out, the European Union really likes this idea of the Brussels effect, right? So
Yeah.
now and then, with the GDPR, that's obviously the major example of it, because it managed to introduce a comprehensive regulatory framework for privacy and personal data protection in that sense, and then basically asked. Or, somehow forced actually other jurisdictions to converge towards it, especially because if you want, like the European Union say that if you want to provide services to EU citizens, you need to comply with the European rules, right?
Yeah.
That's the basis of all of this. So GDPR again did that, already did that, and introduced these rules and said, well, if you want to work with European citizens' personal data, if you want to transfer that data elsewhere, if you want to somehow provide your services based on that personal data of our European citizens, well, you need to comply with GDPR. You need to ensure that there is some safeguards, that there is some protection to that data. And this debate is really interesting, of course, with everything that is happening between the EU and the US, because
Yeah,
now
yeah.
this new privacy framework for sharing data between across the Atlantic is already again put in question by European policymakers and other stakeholders that don't see how the new framework will actually be in compliance with GDPR.
Well,
So again,
and not to interrupt you, Tommaso, because I asked
sorry,
the
yeah.
question around exporting, but I also think it's that specific kind of like transatlantic example with GDPR and privacy also shows why, I mean, there is an incentive to like get your house in order and create a framework that makes sense because the US still kind of lags in having kind of a comprehensive data protection and privacy framework. So there isn't this like analogous set of laws that you can work with GDPR on, and yet you have to because of the strength of the US tech sector. You have to have some cooperation, but you're not really tethering to anything specific. So I'm just thinking into the future. I hope that there is kind of a comprehensive framework or at least clarity in the US by the time it gets implemented. But imagine US companies trying to reconcile that in the absence of some clarity in the US. I hope it's a forcing mechanism.
Yeah, well, that's also the hope that we have, of course, right? And the policymakers obviously had in Europe, but generally that the industry now has, that the US really takes this as an opportunity to, as we say, learn from the European Union, right? See what the European Union did well and try to do better on some aspects maybe. But at least do something. That's more or less
Yeah.
the main hope that we have, right? Because right now the situation in the US with the lack of a clear regulatory framework is clear to everybody that it cannot be sustainable. It cannot go on like that forever. Companies are already considering moving their headquarters to Europe because now they see that the European Union has created a comprehensive framework, has introduced this legal clarity, and they will basically be able to operate, provide their services, knowing exactly what they have to do, what requirements apply to them, and what, is prohibited, and so on, right? So
Yeah.
again, to go back to this super interesting topic, the European Union really, with the MiCA regulation, tried to somehow have a bit of the first mover advantage, right? So to be this first major jurisdiction with this clear regulatory framework for crypto assets, which hopefully will also attract companies, right? Will attract providers of services, innovators that want to somehow set up shop in Europe, and as we just said, have some clear rules for their operations and work. So, and then going back to the global dimension, obviously the European Union is doing this with the idea and the hope also that other jurisdictions will then converge towards its own approach, right? And this
Yeah.
is done in collaboration with IOSCO, with the FSB, with the FATF, right? With all these global bodies. But also, for example, the OECD is doing a lot of important work in that sense, in really trying to converge all the policies and regulatory approaches of their member countries in somehow at least achieving some common standards, right? Obviously, we cannot really expect that a global regulatory framework for crypto assets is going to come up anytime soon. But at least what we are asking as an industry is that there is some common standards, some common definitions, some common understandings are across the globe. And so that these, because we are talking about, as we all know, a global market, a global
Yep.
services, and these global companies that want to operate in Europe, in the US, in Australia, in Africa, wherever they are, obviously they would benefit from having one common approach in all these different jurisdictions rather than having to hire hundreds and hundreds of compliance officers for each different jurisdiction that need to somehow understand how to change their services, their products, their operations to comply with the different set of rules in every single country. So right. Again, the hope is that the MiCA regulation really becomes some sort of an example. Again, it's not perfect. There is things that can be done better. And so hopefully someone will do them better. And maybe that will have a positive impact on the MiCA 2.0 or the new, iterations of the crypto rules that we will have in Europe. But overall, we hope that, in a few years, we can look at the global regulatory situation and be a bit more confident that our sector can operate across the globe with some sort of common rules and common understanding of what is being built in this Web3 ecosystem.
Yeah, that, and you've almost closed us out in a really poignant way. I'm gonna ask two kind of concluding spicy questions for you. One related to this kind of bucket of topics, and then one final wrap up just to scintillate the minds of the listeners. So if you were advising some of the governments that you mentioned, you're in DC, maybe you're going to run up to Capitol Hill or over to the SEC and talk about, or the UK, obviously Australia, India, what have you. If you were to talk to those regulators or those governments, what parts of MiCA would you, Tommaso, want to export? And what would you probably leave behind in Europe in those conversations?
That's a very interesting question. I would say rather than specific parts of MiCA, at this stage, I would probably suggest other jurisdictions to follow the approach that the European Union took, especially when it comes, as we discussed before, to NFTs and DeFi. Mm-hmm. And, being able to acknowledge and to be humble, actually, humble enough for regulators and policymakers to say, I don't understand yet this technology. I don't understand yet this sector. And rather than regulating something that I don't fully understand, I want to study better. I want to get more input, and I want to regulate it once I have understood fully what this sector will be and the actual risks that this sector brings. And I think this is, again, as I said before, it's a really plaudable approach taken by the European Union, which I hope to see replicated elsewhere. So the idea that rather than rushing and regulating, software developers because their software was misused somehow, we should really take the time to understand what can be the liability of some of developers of open source software, for example, or what could even be the responsibilities that can be taken by decentralized entities, right? So the idea that it's better to understand something fully before regulating, I think it's something that I hope to see elsewhere. Now, for the rest, as we said, MiCA is not perfect. It's probably can be very burdensome for some mm-hmm. smaller companies, especially the issuers of stable coins will have a lot of strict requirements on
capital requirements,
own funds, segregation of funds, which are really important, of course. But then, from an operational point of view, will probably create some issues and might actually create an entry barrier, right, for some smaller companies to be able to comply with those. Some other aspects that I will just very quickly flag as being potentially a problem of MiCA is actually, for example, these requirements for e-money token issuers to hold the reserve of assets into commercial banks rather than the central bank. And this is a very interesting debate because then, of course, in Europe, there is this situation with interest rates and the fact that, commercial banks are having the possibility to deposit basically their assets for free in the central banks, but then offer very non-convenient interest rates to their customers. So anyway, that could actually create a potential issue, gatekeeping issue from commercial banks in a sector sector where we are obviously trying to disintermediate, right, and take out the intermediary and the middleman there. So that is probably one of the aspects that I will not recommend other jurisdictions to pick up.
Yeah, yeah. And it also raises this issue of debanking, which we're seeing, yes. Right? And little plug, that was the first topic that I covered in the Substack, because I think it's important, right? You need to, especially in these smaller projects, even larger firms, you need to have some element of operational certainty. And regulation should provide that, not create any opacity. Those are really helpful examples. Okay, so my kind of drum roll, please, final question to wrap us up. It's hard to say, and it's hard to grade, like, is this a good package of regulation? Is it not so great? I'm not going to ask you to do that. I think the metric that I'm going to use, and this is a total prediction, is whether or not you think MiCA is going to inhibit or incentivize crypto innovation in Europe.
So yeah, that is a very good question. And as you say, it is not easy to provide an assessment already of what the MiCA regulation will be in practice, because as we say, the implementation of it will be really important. But overall, I am quite optimistic. I am, and we as a Blockchain for Europe and our industry in general, I think should be happy of the final outcome, because it really... it brings that legal clarity, right? I know we discussed this quite a few times, but that really is the most important point. This legal clarity that will now be, allow companies to come to Europe, innovate, develop their products, develop their services, and knowing exactly what they need to do that, how they can comply with the law. And again, if we look back at the pre-MiCA era in Europe, 27 different member states with 27 different regulatory frameworks, that was not in encouraging innovation, right? That was really actually probably killing a lot of crypto innovation for smaller startups that were maybe looking at developing in Germany, but then once providing services to France would have to completely change their products and businesses, right? So navigating a complex regulatory patchwork of 27 different rule books is really not easy. So now, right, with MiCA, when we have one single rule book for all these companies to know exactly what they can and what they cannot do, well, I'm pretty confident that we will see a lot more of crypto innovation in Europe in the next few years.
Awesome. I love to end on an optimistic note. So thank you. Thank you for this just wonderfully, I know it's difficult to synthesize a complex process, a pretty gnarly piece of regulation, 500 pages, multifaceted, and then also to make some difficult predictions. But I think you nailed it. And I'm so incredibly grateful that you joined us and that you also showcased some of the great work that Blockchain for Europe is doing, and for being such a fantastic ambassador of some of the exciting developments in Europe.
Thank you so much, Katie, for having me and for all the kind words. I think, as you said, we are happy to be a part of this process, and we are happy to be able to provide the industry with a representation in Brussels and with a voice in this whole complicated legislative process. And I'm happy to end on a happy note again, on this confident approach and this confident outlook actually for the future in Europe, right? So I think we've reached an important milestone, and there is a lot of more work to be done, of course, as we discussed in this nice conversation, but I think things are looking good, definitely much better than they are here in the US where I'm talking from right now.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So it's lunchtime in DC. It's dinner time in Berlin. I'm gonna end recording. And if Tommaso and I give each other awesome restaurant recommendations, I'll include them in the show notes as well, so that you guys can follow our culinary adventures as well. But yeah, thanks again, Tommaso.
Thank
really
you.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You, Kitty.
What's a trip around the world without some cultural nuggets? The world is big, it's vibrant, and it's so much more than policy debates. On this episode's layover, I am sharing a poignant moment we had here in Europe. We came to Germany to gather for Easter, celebrate the life of a loved one, and spend time with family. It's been a few weeks of disconnecting to reconnect, spending time in nature among farmland and weathered shorelines, beside fires as it's still quite cold here, and exploring places new and familiar. Last week, my husband and I were wandering the streets of Berlin, arcing toward the Sunday fair at Mauerpark. I spotted a blossomed, lined street and instinctively whipped out my phone. It was stunning. Vignettes abound as we strolled down the picturesque street. One elder chap perched at his window to read a book over top a cherry tree in peak bloom. Others gathered on their stoops. At one particular intersection, we noticed a crowd and several enticing baked goods. It turned out that two neighbors conspired to create a pop-up street fair using a vintage waffle maker to churn out delicious treats, topped with powdered sugar, of course. And a family member of a friend of a friend of a friend, you know how it goes, lent a giant proper espresso machine and barista expertise to froth up artisan cappuccinos. The cost? Whatever you had to give. They'd opened up their homes and creativity to raise funds for victims of the recent earthquakes in Turkey and Syria. And they opened my heart and some waterworks a bit too, if I must confess. I'll link some of the lovely places we visited on this trip if you find yourself in this corner of the world. But there was nothing quite as special or striking as stumbling upon this intersection of openness and care for fellow humanity. All right, folks, thank you so much for checking out this episode of the Worldview Podcast. I've included some links in the show notes, so be sure to check those out. The next edition of the Worldview Substack will be coming out soon, so do subscribe with your email if you're keen for a weekly treat in your inbox. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, subscribe to follow along where you listen to podcasts, and do send me some feedback as we continue to tour the globe with more fabulous guests. Until then, stay curious about the world, stay optimistic about the future, and see you back here on the Worldview soon.